Welcome to the You on the Camino de Santiago podcast, Season 4. This podcast is for and about people getting ready for their first ever pilgrimage on the Camino de Santiago in Spain, France, and Portugal. With your host, Camino guide, and longtime pilgrim, Nancy Reynolds of the Camino Experience. Hola, pilgrims. Welcome back to the show. This is Nancy, your guide and host. If you are new here, let me say a special hello and thank you for tuning in. If you are new here, you may be wondering what this podcast is all about. The idea here is to provide information, resources, inspiration, and empowerment for people getting ready to walk the Camino de Santiago for the first time. The Camino is the ancient pilgrimage route that leads to the cathedral in Santiago de Compostela, Spain, and the remains of St. James, who was one of the 12 apostles of Jesus of Nazareth. I say route, but actually there are many routes that start all throughout Spain, Portugal, and the rest of Europe, and they all lead to the same place, the cathedral and the tomb. My guest today has walked two of those routes, and we will meet David in a few moments. First, I want to update you on a couple of things. First, a couple months ago, the powers that manage online email marketing rules made some changes to how things are done. What does that mean? Here's the question. Are you on my email list? If yes, and if you haven't been receiving an email from me with Camino tips and information at least once a week, then you may have been impacted by the changes. Specifically, if you have a Gmail or Yahoo email address, my emails could be landing in your spam or junk folder instead of in your inbox. This isn't just for my emails, by the way. If you feel like you've stopped getting emails from your favorite retailers or nonprofits, this could be why. They could all be in your spam folder. What to do about it? It's easy. Go to spam, find any emails that you actually want to be receiving, open them up, and click on Not Spam. You could also add the email address they come from to your contacts. My email address, by the way, is nancy@thecaminoexperience.com. Now, this reminds me to mention, if you're not currently on my email list, you can get on my list by going to my website, and there you'll find a sign-up sheet to get my top 10 Camino tips that don't usually show up on the top 10 lists. You could also follow the link in the show notes to get onto that list and get those top 10 tips. Okay, next thing. This is for anyone who is dreaming of walking the Camino de Santiago, specifically the Frances route. If you are finding your plans have stalled, or if you're feeling overwhelmed with all the details of pulling together your pilgrimage plan, I want you to know that help is available. If you aren't sure even where to start with your planning, or if you would simply like to talk about what it would mean to get started with a small group from the beautiful French town of Saint-Jean-Pied-du-Port, let's connect. I have a few places left in the group I'm leading in September. If you know in your heart that this is your year to walk the Camino, let's talk. You can reach me at nancy@thecaminoexperience.com. And wait, if you are tuning into this podcast episode and you don't know what the Camino is, or if you haven't yet noticed it pulling on your heart, then I want to direct you to two resources. The first is the rest of this podcast series. If you go back to Season 1, Episode 1, which released in August 2022, you will get a good idea of what walking the Camino pilgrimage is all about. The other resource is my website. I specialize in assisting first-time pilgrims on the Camino Frances route in getting to their starting point and taking their first steps. I would love to know if I can assist you in making this life-expanding journey. You can find out how on my website, thecaminoexperience.com. Now, let me tell you about my guest. David Ault is a visionary leader in the Human Potential Movement who has been promoting mindfulness, global literacy, and social justice for over 30 years. He has traveled the world as a teacher and heart-centered guide with the sole purpose of bridging our collective forgetfulness into our great collective reawakening. As an award-winning author, leadership and personal coach, and global education advocate, David exemplifies his motto that people would rather see a lesson than hear one. He is the founder of Kaleidoscope Child Foundation, a nonprofit organization that empowers vulnerable children and communities worldwide with sustainable education, life skills, and fresh water. Since its inception more than 20 years ago, Kaleidoscope has established schools in Siem Reap, Cambodia, and Bodh Gaya and Lakhanpur, India. And David has collaborated with literacy and hygiene programs in Guatemala, Africa, and the United States, serving more than 1,000 children annually. David is also an avid adventurer. He has walked two of the routes of the Camino de Santiago. He has hiked the Inca Trail to the ruins of Machu Picchu in Peru, and he has summited Kilimanjaro in Africa. David regularly leads groups on sacred site journeys and service trips, and he constantly marvels at the wisdom gained through cultural immersion. As a respected teacher, writer, and columnist, David is the author of the bestseller, Where Regret Cannot Find Me, and the multi-award-winning, The Grass is Greener Right Here. I first met David when he led a workshop at my church on setting intentions. I was listening quite attentively during the workshop because this is something that I do for every one of my pilgrimages on the Camino. So imagine my delight when David casually referenced the Camino in the workshop. Since then, I have been loosely following David's work with Kaleidoscope and his 2023 Camino journey. A few weeks ago, a mutual friend very kindly connected us, and David graciously agreed to be my guest. Our conversation wandered over two of the Camino routes and a number of themes that emerged on David's pilgrimages. I took away some new thoughts on how to reflect on my Camino journeys, and I hope you will do the same. If you'd like to connect with David and learn more about his books and nonprofit work, be sure to check the show notes for those links. David is joining me today from his home in Atlanta, Georgia. Here we go. David, hi. Thank you so much for being with me on the podcast today.
Oh, I'm so excited. I have been looking forward to this for so long.
I know. Me too. Yeah. It's the kind of thing where you listen to Dr. Edwards' episode where I was looking forward to that one thinking, what is he going to say? What is going to come out? I was just so excited about that. And I feel the same way with you because of who I know you to be, one as a pilgrim and the other as a leader in the New Thought movement and in Centers for Spiritual Living and all the incredible things you've done since then. Mm. So I'm interested to see where this goes.
Yeah, thank you. I feel like you and I could just sit like we're pretending we're drinking coffee somewhere, probably on the Camino.
Yes.
Having our café con leche.
Yeah.
And just pretend everybody else is eavesdropping.
Let's do that. That sounds great. I have already had my coffee, but it is decaf. So I won't talk too fast out of excitement for this conversation. So let's start where I always like to start, which is to put the pin in the map. Would you share with us your experience on the Camino?
Oh, gosh. I am privileged to have been able to do two of them and with quite a bit of distance in between. So my first Camino was in 2009, and it was the traditional route. And That was, I would say that that was a lifelong birthing process. I was turning 50 and I wanted to do something monumental. And as I was thinking about the possibilities of that, I just kept going back to this longing that I have always had for adventure. I used to talk a lot of times about values, and I would say adventure is always in my top five values.
Right on.
And that to me was birthed from just life circumstance and having grown up in poverty in Southeast Texas and all different types of other challenging circumstances. And I would hide in trees.
Oh.
I would hide in the trees with books. And I would read books about famous people and the accomplishments, but I would also read and had the wherewithal, even at a, as a young boy, to understand their adversity. And there would be sort of this transference where I would go, well, gosh, if they can do what they did in spite of, maybe I could too. And so it planted this seed of longing to see the world and pacifying that need for adventure. And I will just say, currently, the word also that cohabitates with that now is disruption. I'm a huge lover of disruption.
Okay, I just got chills. So we're going to have to dig into that one for sure.
Conscientious disruption. The, you know, the shaking of the sleeping self, as we might say. And so I'm approaching this milestone age and wanted to do something. And at the time, it was right after the big recession. And everything that I had sort of saved and pocketed in certain little areas kind of dwindled. And there was a commitment that I'm still going to do this anyway.
Do you mean your financial resources dwindled?
My financial resources dwindled. And I thought, I'm going to figure out how to do this anyway.
Right.
And that's another story, but I did. And off I went to celebrate turning 50 on this Camino. And another part that's sort of valuable to the story is I was born in a family that got to co-create with a genetic heart disease. And so I was one of those too. And so something like the Camino and all of the mythical questions that I had in my mind, oh my God, can I do this? I put that aside as well. And I was determined to go. And I was working with a spiritual mentor at the time. And the thing he said to me right before I left was, I'm so glad you're doing this. You're going to die many deaths.
Okay, chills again. Why did he say that?
And I was like, what? What? He said, you're going to die many deaths. And he didn't elaborate. He left it like this big overhanging question. Like, what does he mean by that? And I can tell you, obviously, how that came to be for me. But I just didn't expect that they would all be in the first day.
Oh, gosh.
Or the majority of them were in the first day. And so my experience going back to 2009 was I made my way to Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port and checked in and was just beside myself with excitement and anticipation and nervousness. And there was a hostel there in Saint-Jean that I checked in and didn't sleep a wink the night beginning. And I believe it was me and maybe 8 or 9 smelly Frenchmen who all snored, no sleep whatsoever. And I get up before sunrise and embark upon this thing. And the first death on the first day of my first Camino was the death of comparison.
Oh.
Because, again, mythically, I'm told that you stay in these places and you check in and that it's according to how much space there is. You might get a bed, you might not get a bed. And so to someone who's never done it before, that really eats at our need to control the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what does that mean? And where would I sleep? And so all of those ambiguous questions are floating in my mind as I'm starting to walk across the Pyrenees. And so people are passing me. I'm not very fast. I've got great endurance, but speed was not my friend. And so when somebody would pass me, let's say, just a fellow pilgrim, I didn't see them as a fellow pilgrim. I saw them as a bed stealer.
Aha, yes.
And I was like, no. And so all of this turmoil and all of this angst about what's going to happen and what's going to happen was just really churning away. And something jolted me because I went, wait a minute, David, you're walking across the frickin' Pyrenees, for goodness sake. When will you ever possibly have this opportunity again? Why are you so focused upon the bed at the end of the day? And something said, turn around. And I did a whole circumference panoramic turnaround looking at where I was. And I know you've done these pilgrimages many times, but I was often told that the Pyrenees is a fickle mistress.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
That you never know whether you're going to see anything or not, whether it will be ensconced in clouds and fog, or whether or not you will have this beautiful panorama. And on that day, it was just as clear as a bell. And I turned around and I was in awe. It was like that precious moment of clarity and beauty, and I just soaking it all in. And these three words came to me, and these three words sort of became part of my inner mantra. And it was, solution already exists.
Oh, yes.
Meaning that the bed, whatever the bed represents or wherever you're going to stay, that is already in existence. Why remove yourself from the beauty of this moment? No matter how physically challenging it might be, why remove yourself from that and continue focusing on this fictitious future when you've got all of this beauty around you? And it was, as I retell it to you, it's sort of pedantic, but in that moment, it, like, everything within me cellularly came alive. And I started laughing at those words, solution already exists. And I started being very playful with it. It was like all of the things that we claim to discover, for example. And in that first day crossing the Pyrenees over into the Basque country of Spain, I was like, do we ever really discover anything? Or do we just uncover what is already in existence?
Okay, we're getting a little metaphysical here.
Yeah, I mean, just laughing at, like, this is a crude example, but Columbus discovers America. And, you know, we have our thoughts about Columbus, but he didn't discover America. He uncovered the landmass that was already in existence. And I correlated that with this, the fact that you will uncover whatever your needs are in that moment. And it just kept building and building upon itself. And I like to think that such adventures like the Camino and this disruption bring those things to life that are within us. You know, they jolt us from a sort of sedentary dullness that we can collapse into. And for that one, there's dozens and dozens more where it has jolted me into life.
Sure, sure. The Camino does have a way to do of doing that. And that's why when we talk to people who have walked the Camino, it's a very different conversation than people who haven't walked it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to make the observation, you come with a background, a career background that sets you up for eyes wide open on these sort of metaphysical interpretations of things. Will you share your background and in career? And then we're going to go back to finish putting the pin in the map.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I, like many people's story, I grew up in a particular religion. It wasn't necessarily the religion that continuously fed me or that I subscribed to. And like many, we outgrow things. Mm-hmm. And in order to grow, you have to outgrow. And so I didn't know anything different than the religion of my childhood, mm-hmm. Which was very oppressive and fundamentalist and this and that and the other, and very us and them, and you're going to go to hell. And so, interestingly, not knowing anything different, I was so certain that it wasn't for me that I was willing to risk the chance to leave it and face the aftermath, only because this just couldn't be possible. You know, I was a kid that questioned, and all those books helped me question. It was like, how could I have won a geographical lottery when all of these other people around the world, you know, they just, mm-hmm. what, where's the love in that if they're condemned? So the things like that, you know, kind of pushed me or gave me the courage to leave. And I had moved to New York City, and I was an actor, and an opportunity came for me. I will say that even though I tired of this in my teenage years, I still went to a rather famous Christian university.
Oh, okay.
Coming from nothing, a scholarship was the only means by which I could have continued my education. And I got a journalism scholarship to North Texas State, and I was so excited. But my mother, who's very entrenched in the religion, said to me that God told her, and the joke is, if your mom starts a sentence with "God told me," there's very little room for debate, that I was to go to Oral Roberts University.
Oh.
So to me, it was a continuance of the thing that I was already highly discontented in, but I went anyway because of this scholarship situation. So leaving that, went immediately to New York City to pursue this acting career. I got bit by the bug in theater and got an opportunity to come to LA. Literally ran into someone on the street that I had gone to Oral Roberts University with. And he was inviting me to something. And my interpretation of it, because of our shared background, was that he was inviting me to church. Huh. And I had long claimed my freedom from that. So I resisted and pushed back. And he saw that and he goes, no, this is different. And that became my doorway into finding Louise Hay.
Okay.
And then being in a singing group with her because of my friend and the music department that we had shared at Oral Roberts. And so the joke is, maybe my mom did hear God's voice, because that chain of events led me, and Louise became like my second mom.
Oh, wow.
Toured for years, and that was my doorway, a very precious, sacred doorway into New Thought.
Okay.
And she mentored me, and I said, yeah. So I studied just because it felt good to me, but that led to becoming a minister and.
Would you say just a few words about what New Thought is? Because I bet some of my listeners are not familiar with New Thought and the New Thought movement.
Sort of the textbook version is that it has its roots in the transcendentalist movement, which was a group with Ralph Waldo Emerson and a bunch of luminaries at the time in the 18th century that began to have these awarenesses that God wasn't a deity, but that God was, let's say, an energy or a life force. And Emerson used to talk all the time about nature as God, the beauty and the infinite intelligence that exists within all living things is the same infinite intelligence that lives in all living things, including ourselves. And it created this bridge or this busting through the myth of separation between us as a human and the deity in the sky, but beginning to contemplate that God is in everything, is everything. Or if the word God doesn't work, that it's love or intelligence or wholeness. And that sort of foundational invitation to begin to re-examine belief systems was very appealing to me.
I found the same when I found the New Thought movement. Yeah, I was raised in the Methodist Church, which is soft and gentle, and pancake breakfast on Easter and potlucks and things like that, and choir singing and hymns and all that. Very gentle and very, very welcoming and kind. And then I got away from that. And so when I found New Thought, it was like, oh, this is nice. This is welcoming. This is kind. It was really a sweet way to get back into, mm-hmm. I'll say get back into religion, but get back into the community that forms around religions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's go back to the Camino then. Now that we sure. have a foundational, yeah. So you come from a ministerial background in a New Thought movement that has a very open and oneness-based way of looking at things. And then you took that onto the Camino. So for me, it's no wonder that that's how your first day went.
Mm.
So what happened after that? So let's finish the pin in the map. You started in Saint-Jean. Your first pilgrimage ended where?
I went all the way to Santiago.
Okay.
I don't know if this is true now, but back then, when I checked into the pilgrim's office in Saint-Jean, mm-hmm. I was asked the question, how many days, first of all, how far are you going? I said, all the way. And then they said, how many days have you planned? And I had a rough idea. I think I said 34.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this to be true because I still have these things folded in my first passport. She went to a 34-day map. Like they had all these different individual maps, and it gave me an outline of how many kilometers to expect to traverse and options of places to stay. And I will say, this sort of sounds like an old purist in me, I loved the fact that I did the Camino at that time when cell phones were not rampant.
Yes.
Because I had one. It was whatever the style and model was at the time. But I knew that when it was over, I was going to have to call for a particular transportation detail. But in the beginning, I wrapped it in bubble wrap and put it at the bottom of my backpack and never touched it.
I love that.
Never touched it. And so pictures were all from the little Canon Instamatics, and there was little to no internet activity. There were internet cafes at the time still.
Do you remember the kiosks that were in the albergues?
Yes, I do.
Those were the best. These big clunky things. They look like Pac-Man games or big video games. And you sit down and little screen and it's...
Sometimes there was a line and it was like, I'm not going to wait.
Sometimes they worked and sometimes they didn't. Yeah. You have to put in a euro. I remember it was like a euro or 2 euros yeah, for 20 yeah. minutes or whatever. That was amazing.
And not having, and now having done it 2 years ago and seeing the vast contrast of that, I'm glad that I had that. I'm glad that I had that purist experience, because one's not good and the other bad. They're just different.
Very true.
That first one, I have so many incredible stories about just moment-to-moment awareness and moment-to-moment dialogue with people, and just so much beauty where I was not looking down at something.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking forward. I was up. My head was up and I was aware. And it really is quite remarkable to think that for 34 days to have that kind of beautiful conscientious disruption from the way the rest of life was.
Absolutely. My first Camino was in 2005, and smartphones didn't exist yet.
Oh my God.
Not only that, there was no English language guidebook widely distributed. So I didn't have anything. I showed up in Pamplona and went, okay, where do I go? What do I do? And the hospitalero took me outside and he pointed to a sign that had a symbol of a walker, a scallop shell, and an arrow. And he said, do you see that? I said, yeah. He goes, go that way. That's all I had.
Wow.
Amazing. I'm so like you. I'm so grateful for that first experience. And I didn't get a smartphone on the Camino until I started leading groups in 2013. Yeah, just didn't even have it. It's amazing. So yeah. Let's fast forward to your most recent Camino experience and put the pin in the map for that one. Where did you start and finish and how long did you take?
The second one was the Portuguese route. And so I had been to Portugal once before, to Lisbon, and I loved it. And I thought, oh, this would be good, because I didn't think I had as much time. And what I was going to do with this Camino was use it as a promotional tool for my nonprofit.
Okay, good.
And as we've all shared, the commonality of COVID and everything we went through. So I run a foundation that is a global education organization that provides that for children in slums and in vulnerable territories across the world. And like everybody else, there was a great challenge with funding during COVID and programming and how do we keep things sustained and what do we need to let go of? And so it was a lot to carry. And in order to bring some vibrancy or to jolt people about our work, I thought, let me walk the Camino. And use it as an awareness tool for Kaleidoscope Child Foundation, and use it as a fundraising attempt while walking. And so, like we talked about, that was a complete 180 with the phone and social media and all of that. But I will say I loved the Portugal route.
Okay. What did you love about it?
I loved the people. And if people are examining the Portugal route, you will see there's all these different variants. You will see that there's a coastal option and a central option. And in the central option, there are other variants towards the end. And I just decided that I would stick to the central variant. Plus, I was toying with the idea of wanting to go to Fatima. I said,
okay,
what would be another opportunity in life, to want to see that? So that's the route that I took. And I started in the beginning. I started at the cathedral in Lisbon and walked the whole way. Wow. And it took me 30 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
So thinking about who you were then versus who you were in 2009, and everything that had transpired between then, you had grown your foundation and your nonprofit. Mm-hmm. Who walked the second Camino as compared to the first Camino?
I would like to say a far more wise elder, but I will say that some of those repeated lessons came up again. And I saw just the cyclical nature of being human. And one of my favorite awarenesses in the Portuguese route in 2022 was, first of all, I walked in July. So for any listeners out there,
yikes,
I would say, unless you're walking in a Speedo or a bikini, you don't want to do it. It was just brutal, temperature wise. And it was the only time that I could do this, and the foundation really needed the money. So off we go. But there was a day leading up to something that the locals nicknamed Goat Mountain. And they called it Goat Mountain because they said no one but goats should be up there.
I have a picture in my mind.
Yeah. And it was this really difficult ascent, and probably the most difficult ascent on the Portuguese route. And I was dreading it. And not just because of the heat, but again, because I have great stamina, but sometimes the ascension stuff can really drain everything out of me. And so I had gotten up early that morning and I was standing at the foot of Goat Mountain, just bemoaning what was before me.
Oh.
Just like, and I said, as we often do, I wish this was over, or I wish I was already up there. And then all of a sudden, the word process came to me, not a big awareness, but just that everything is process. And I'm like, okay, yeah. No, it's like, no, everything is process. Everything is process. And suffering comes from wanting to be somewhere else in the process other than where you are. And it was just like, it was this quiet sort of wash over my mind. Suffering is wanting to be anywhere other than where you are in the process.
That's genius.
And as I stood there, I thought, okay, just put one foot in front of the other. And while I'm ascending Goat Mountain, I am going to try to find something in life that is an exception to process.
Okay.
Before you know it, I was at the top and I had not found one thing.
Uh-huh.
Illness, career, the 24-hour capsule of a day. It doesn't matter if it's morning and you want it to be night, or a child wanting it to be Christmas. It's like none of those things, no matter how much we yearn for them, is going to change the now moment. We will not be in that moment. And it mirrored exactly the first story that I told you about being on the Pyrenees, wanting that assurance of, I want to know what the bed situation looks like. I want to, you know. And it was really quite profound. One of my favorite teachers of all times is Ram Dass, Be Here Now.
Yes, that's what he meant.
That's what Be Here Now is.
Well, and it's actually what I heard. I heard the beauty of the insight. And also I hear a strategy for how to get through those difficult times. What you did was you gave your mind something to work on, something specific to work on.
Right.
Yeah. And so there's our parallel strategy. One is be here now, turn around, look behind you and see the beauty from where you have come. Mm-hmm. And give your mind something to do, because it's going to do something anyway. You may as well have it do what you want.
And to me, the ascending up that mountain is a perfect metaphor for just navigating humanness. Mm. And we can either bemoan the journey or stay committed to the themes or the woundings or the past of the journey and carry that with us. Or we can just begin to practice that everything is a process. And there is quite, and I will say this through practice, that there is tremendous joy in just the simplicity of the awareness of the now.
I could not agree more. Yeah. And that's one of the things, I think that's one of the gifts of the Camino, is that when we slow down to the pace of walking, we are in that moment and we practice it every day on the Camino. And my experience has been that it's now mine. I have that ability and that awareness to drop into the present moment anywhere, anytime, no matter what. But I had to practice it.
And there's these beautiful examples of that. So on the Portuguese route in the guidebook, there's a recommendation, if it's at all possible, stay at this particular albergue. And it's run by a husband and wife, and she cooks every day for the X number of people that stay at their place. And so I thought, all right, I'm going to do what I can because the book is telling me I should go there. And she's been doing this for years. And what I loved was, for those who haven't done it yet, you check in, you have your little passport, you get your stamp, and you either wash your clothes or find some meal or shower or do whatever. And this kind of sacred routine keeps happening. So I reach her place and I check in and I go to pay. And she goes, no pay until you leave. So that was different. But what she was doing was, is she would not stamp your passport until the following morning after you agreed to stay for breakfast.
Oh.
So note how many people are like anticipating, oh, I'm going to leave at this time to blah, blah, blah. And she was like, nope, you're going to sit family style for breakfast. And I'm
Oh.
going to stamp your passport until you have eaten your breakfast.
Wow. Talk about care and
Yeah.
hospitality.
And people were like, no, I'm going to get up at six. And, it's like, nope.
No, you're not. And did most people stick around for that
They
stamp?
all did. They all.
Oh, do you want to say where that was so my listeners can make sure they don't miss it?
I would have to look it up, but I can send it to you.
Any chance her name was Fernanda?
I think that sounds familiar.
Yeah, she does have quite a reputation. There's a woman named Fernanda who I believe has
Yeah.
quite a reputation. Yeah.
I mean, and we're not talking just breakfast. There was food provided when you got there, little appetizers. There was then an evening meal. And then there was the communal breakfast. And she
Fabulous.
did this every
Every
day.
day. You know, and for many people, that's the picture that they have in their mind of what the Camino experience is. What would you say the Camino experience is?
It's connecting at a it's connecting and I mean that in a way that is outside the dull routine of our regular lives. And so you talk to people and you interface with people in circumstances that normally you wouldn't. There's a sort of awakened curiosity within us to know more about someone else, particularly those who have the same pace as you, because you see them
Yes.
all the time. But I will say I'm still connected to many of these people.
That's the story we hear.
Yeah, I wish there was. Maybe I will come up with a more juicy word than connection, but that really is sort of the real deal there.
And we all know that word and have an understanding of it. And if we take that word with us to the Camino, we can explore it and uncover what else it might mean for us.
And there's also surrender, which is so incredibly powerful. I'm sure you've that we always say the Camino provides. And it isn't that the Camino holds some miraculous thing that doesn't exist anywhere else. But when you're on the Camino, there's a sort of exhale, a sort of permission that one gives themselves to be more and more aware of these provisional things and this beauty that most of the time we're just too busy to notice.
Well said.
Camino providing is really not out of the realm of the norm. It's just that we've positioned ourselves to be able to see it.
Yes. I had a wonderful conversation with someone last year when I was staying at Robinal del Camino on the Frances route, and we were talking about the Camino provides, and I was like, but don't you think that life provides, the universe provides? I mean, we know that, but what's up? And she goes, you know what, Nancy? The Camino provides is the gateway to understand that the universe provides, that life provides, that God provides. And for many people, we discover on the Camino what that feels like. And then we want that all the time. And then we go home and try to figure out how to get that back. I want to go back to the what you did on the Portuguese route when you were recording. I think you recorded a video every day. Is that true?
Yeah, I was trying to reach a donor base. I was again using social media as a way to invite people to go on the journey with me. And it wasn't anything fancy. It was just my phone and the little earplug microphone. And I will say that there were many days particularly in that kind of heat where the last thing that I wanted to do was record a message. But it would sort of require me to take a breath and sometimes go and find little spots within the neighboring streets or alleyways or spaces that we were in to get enough quiet to be able to offer my reflection and to thank people. So I'm a huge proponent of doing my best to thank everybody for their gifts, their support, their donations. And so there was a lot of administration.
Sure.
Portugal version.
Oh, and well, and I ask that because I do see and hear about people who are recording their journeys and posting something. Some of them post every day in Facebook groups. Some of them are on something like Find Penguins or Polar Steps. And I'm always curious about what impact that has on the actual pilgrimage. Does it take away from the experience? Does it add to the experience? What was your take on that?
I can only speak for myself that I wouldn't want to do it again.
Okay.
You know, I want to find a beautiful balance between what I experienced in the first one and the most recent one. And sure, the phone will be there, but I want to find a way to blend those moments where I'm not worried about or trying to administer where I will be. Mm-hmm. And just, but see, that's me. I'm good with that kind of stuff. I'm good with the spontaneity. You're hearing it here. I'm good with the not knowing a lot of times. And I understand that other people are not, and that has been cultivated for me. Mm. So there is a sort of romanticized version of the Camino of going back, and I know that I will, where I don't even make the reservation. I just go.
That was my next question, is when are you going back and which route?
Definitely I'm going back.
This is being recorded.
I've done a lot in my life to purposefully create enough freedom. Like, I've done everything within my power to eliminate my debt. I've done all the kinds of things to live frugally. I get to travel a lot of times just because of work, but I'm not a person that just uses the money for that, because I want experiences. Mm-hmm. And I want to go back. And people who don't know the Camino go, why would you want to go back? And it's like, it is. It's the ultimate bug that bites you. Mm-hmm. So there's many things that I've considered doing, the northern route. Strangely, I would probably pick Portugal over the traditional route. Okay, again.
Over the Frances, yeah.
Yeah. I would do some more of the variants. You know, as much as I loved the traditional route and everything that it provided for me, there was something about the people of Portugal. There was something about the villages. And just, I just remember one time coming through some valley, and there was a sheep herder, and there was these sheep, and there was this ancient Roman wall, and everything about it was something out of mythology. And I just took my backpack off and I sat on that wall, and I had the same experiences on the Camino Francois route as well. It's maybe a personal thing. I don't know.
It's okay not to have an answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's okay. So many people going for the first time are just going because they have to, they're called to, they need something. Their soul is longing for whatever they think this might provide, mm-hmm. but also for what they don't know it will provide.
Yeah.
Mm. So let's talk a little bit more about Kaleidoscope. You want to share a bit more about your work with that?
The same kind of sense of adventure that I talked about being birthed as a child fostered the creative ways to find opportunities for global travel. And one of those was when I was a musician in my Louise Hay era days. You cultivate mailing lists, mm-hmm. and then you keep building on those mailing lists. And a fellow musician just sort of casually mentioned to me that there are companies that will work with you. And if you use your mailing list and you get 15 people, you can go to XYZ. And I was like, what? And so that happened. I went to China, and I didn't really have any aspirations to go to China, but they had all these tours to China. And I'm like on the Great Wall with all of these people who signed up to come. And I'm like, oh my God.
So you were leading, were you leading this group?
So it was people who were on my list who came with me on this tour, but then there were guides.
Oh.
So there were structured tours, sort of sacred site travel kinds
okay.
of things. And I would do a bunch of those.
Mm.
And I, for that little boy hiding up in the tree, that was just nirvana for me. And one of those late in the game was a trip to Thailand and Cambodia, and didn't know anything about Cambodia. I wasn't aware of Angkor Wat or the spiritual temple complex there. People signed up. Thailand was great. But when we got to Cambodia, I heard Dr. Edwards say on your episode about sometimes you arrive and there's this visceral feeling in these travels and in these adventures. And that happened to me in Cambodia. There was this just ancient homecoming. There was this fascination with the equanimity of the people and the fact that they had been through this brutal civil war and that millions of them had perished. But it was also the first time where most of the people on the tour were witnessing the distinction between the haves and the have-nots.
Okay.
And that collective empathy is like, oh, we should do something. And I'm so glad that I was naive at the time about all the correctedness around those things. I didn't know anything about phrases like sympathy travel. You know, I was just like, hey, let's, you know, what do you want to do? And we had conversations with the guide, and I said, we're here for a limited time. This is a one-off. Why don't you just take us to the worst situation? And that ended up being feeding incredibly hungry children on the banks of a lake there. And that changed my life. And I was not a person of means, and I had no understanding of nonprofits or what any of that would mean or entail. It just knew in that moment that there was something here. And there was a mantra that I was using a lot in those days that I read from an article, and it was, I'm available.
I love that.
And it's from this writer named Doug Boyd. And he said, the most powerful mantra you can ever say is, I'm available. And he followed it with, look out. Because if you're serious, your whole world will change.
Yeah.
Oh, and yikes. It was this just massive, you know, heart exploding thing that took place on the banks of that lake with those children and the desperation and the starvation and whatnot. And I said, I'm available. And I kept going back to Cambodia, and it took 5 years to get through all of the bureaucracy, and we opened a school.
What year was your first visit?
That was 2004, so okay. A year before your first Camino. And it took till 2009 for me to figure out what I was doing and to get government approval to open an NGO there. And then that I had to come back here and then create a nonprofit stateside that would fund the NGO.
Okay.
And so that's 20 years I've been hitting and missing, figuring out what to do. And today we've got two campuses in Cambodia with almost 600 children this year. And sometimes it's been more. And we have food programs and English programs and IT technology programs and math programs and sewing and life skills and water and hygiene initiatives. And I went to India, and we've got two schools in slum areas there. And those kids are just brilliant. And then we work with a school in Guatemala to support getting girls out of slave trade practices in order to get education. And we're working with a school in Kenya and doing stuff in the US. And so it's all centered around global education. And a lot of it is the empowerment of girls and hygiene and sanitation. And yeah, so.
Hats off, really. Yeah. That's amazing work. That's a 20-year path that has impacted so many lives. Mm. Yeah. What's next for Kaleidoscope? Where are you headed?
This year we're sort of focusing on strengthening what we have. There's no buildings, there's none of that, because in January of 2025. There's a documentarian that is going to follow me, and he is and his team and company are raising the funds to make this documentary about the work, which would help. That's what I call a piece of the long game.
Okay.
Because the long game with regards to funding and grants, but also in something that is really important, which is endowments. Mm. I can't believe that I am in my mid-60s. And I'm like, wow, I mean, I'm just going to keep going. And I'm not overly concerned about what will happen to everything. I'm trying not to be one of those people. And at the same time, paradoxically, I'm doing everything within my power to leave it foundationally financed.
Sure.
Long after I'm no longer on the planet. So endowments are a way to make that happen. Okay. And so we're hoping that maybe the film will be a part of securing something like that in the future.
Wonderful. So let's make sure we know how to support Kaleidoscope and the work that you're doing. How do people connect with you? How do they make donations? Or endowments, let's think big.
Yeah, so our website is kaleidoscopechildfoundation.org.
Okay, I'll have that in the show notes.
You go there and you can get a really nice overview of our work and the history of our work and the timelines. And I would say too, in India, which has become seriously my favorite, just in terms of families and culture and everything. One of the baked in elements of culture is that young girls in India don't leave if they're in rural territories. They don't leave their homes, their families, just a cultural thing. And there was an awareness that I had sitting on the floor of a cow barn after a pilot program and watching these girls just absorbing this knowledge after 1 year of exposure. So of having no literacy whatsoever, to just mind blowing me away. And then I thought, oh my God, what have you done? Because they're never going to leave these rural villages. And there's a saying in the nonprofit world, you can't care about some of it, you got to care about all of it. And that has led to securing land with a dream to build a school and a place for village mothers to be able to promote their goods and services that they have begun using sewing machines and things like that to create autonomy, but also to have a work center. So we're concentrating on unrolling health and science and math and technology courses for these young girls so that they can come to the center that we want to build and still go home and not disrupt their culture or their lives in that way, but still maintain their own autonomy.
What a beautiful design to that overreaching concept of respecting the culture, maintaining the culture, and tapping into their potential and what's possible. Beautiful. Yeah. All right. So I'll have the website in the show notes if anyone wants to look into that. I did look at the website. It's a beautiful website. Gives you a good idea of the heart of what you're doing. So yeah, so I'll make sure I've got that. And you are on Instagram as well, I think.
Kaleidoscope Child Foundation is on Instagram, and yours truly is on Instagram.
Yeah, David Alt on Instagram. Very good. All right. Anything else you'd like to share?
Oh gosh. If the idea to walk the Camino has ever floated in your mind, take that as a push from the universe, as an invitation from the universe. Don't worry about the how, and just begin to prepare and
say yes.
Yeah, there's a somebody said one time that resource follows commitment, and I always loved that. About, you know, sometimes we get caught up in the details of resource. How would I do that? How will the time, when will I get all this? How would I make that work to be gone that long? And it's like, if you just commit and incrementally make that commitment spread a little bit more and then spread a little bit more, it's fascinating the way, as we were talking about, the universe or resource seems to appear in ways that we would have never been aware of or paying attention. It wouldn't have crossed our radar. And so that's something I really work with people a lot on is find the thing. I'm in this meditation course, and the Buddhist Lama said this week, he said, what are you devoted towards? Not to, but towards. What are you devoted towards? And when he said that, it's like my brain just went, because we're devoted to many things, to people and to goals and things like that. But towards to me was more like the essence, like, you know, the value, like devoted towards continuing to be adventurous. And so that's very expansive. What are you devoted towards?
There's a movement to it too, isn't there? There's a pulling forth and a drawing forward, that you're going in a direction.
I love those ideas. There's a metaphysical teacher that you and I are pretty aware of. And he said, if ever the thought appears in mind, know that all the ways and the means to bring that thought to fruition are also in that same mind.
Yes. I think we should end on that.
Yeah.
It's a great one.
That's Thomas Troward.
Yeah. Some really good thought in that old, new thought, old stuff. Because that's not new. That's not new. It's the movement that's new.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I would like to end on that note. I just really appreciate that. And I appreciate the perspective and the depth of wisdom that you bring to this conversation. Thanks for that.
Oh, thank you.
All right. That's it. Okay. Thank you, David.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.